You know probably that I travel a great deal on behalf of the church, and this past year I've been to a number of areas that are experiencing periods of crisis and trouble, and I've seen how this affects teenagers there, and I'll be addressing myself to teens mostly today. I've seen how this is affecting teens who are in the church and teens who are not in the church. I had the chance not too long ago to spend a couple of days in the Persian Gulf, even out on the waters of the Persian Gulf, just a short distance from where Iran has been defying the U.S. Navy, an area right in the Middle East where there are a number of wars and rebellions occurring. I spent time in the Congo, what Joseph Conrad called the heart of darkness back in the 1800s, and in some ways it's still that way today. I'll be back there again next month. There's a state of almost permanent unrest there, which has been going on for months because the president just unilaterally announced it wasn't possible to hold elections at the end of his mandate. He's constitutionally prevented from being president any longer, but he just announced until elections could be organized, which would take at least 2 years, he's continuing. So demonstrators have been shot and killed in the streets, and that's an ongoing situation. We have about 100 people attending services in Kinshasa, which is where most of the violence is occurring, and so our teens in that area, they're witnessing some of this firsthand. The country of Burundi has been undergoing a similar circumstance because of a contested election. There are members there that send me pictures on social media. They send me pictures of bodies in the streets or people who have been killed with machetes. You can imagine how awful something like that would be. And over the years that I've served the church, I've actually seen some of those things myself, bodies in the street and so on and so forth. We're used to thinking of those things as happening over there. But in the course of the last few months and years, we're realizing that those things are starting to happen over here. Terror attacks now have affected places that used to be safe from that sort of thing, places like France, Belgium, Germany, Great Britain, and of course the United States as well. We see that in our society, people are becoming less civil. There's more hatred. There's more violence, whether it's verbal or physical, than what we used to see. And I would like for us to think about a couple of questions today during the time of the sermon. How did the world come to be that way in the first place? Why is it getting worse, and why is it going to get worse before it gets better? Is there anything we can do to help? And how can we remain hopeful and have peace, inner peace, as these trends continue? The theme for the Winter Family Weekend this year is Faith and Hope in a Troubled World. And if you were able to get one of the programs, you probably read the write-up, which says this: God's promises about our destiny and mankind's future give the life of Christians great meaning during troubled times. Jesus Christ states in John 14:27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I leave with you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." Although we live in a world that is anything but peaceful, with the help of God's Holy Spirit, we can experience a great deal of inner peace. This peace and understanding is not grasped by most people today, but as Jesus Christ makes clear, he provides as no other. Faith, hope, and peace in a troubled world. How does that work? How can that happen? One thing we need to understand as we begin is that there's something surprising about the peace that God gives. It's probably not the kind of peace most people would imagine when they hear that word, and they imagine what that would mean. The peace that a Christian can know happens in rather remarkable circumstances and in remarkable ways. Turn with me, if you would, to John chapter 6, verse 33. John chapter 6, verse 33. And I apologize, I wrote that down wrong. I'll read you the quote, and you can look it up in the Bible later. You will recognize the words. I'm not pulling a fast one on you here. Jesus said, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." Now, at first glance, that can seem contradictory. How can you have that in the world, tribulation, great trials, heavy trials in the world, and yet have peace? How is it possible to do that? Well, Jesus mentioned part of what it was at the end of the verse. He said, "Have no fear, I have overcome the world." So you're going to have tribulation in the world. There are going to be stressful times. But he showed us that it's possible to overcome the world. It's possible to win. It's possible to engage in that struggle and to win. How can that be? How can we have that peace? Well, what we see in this verse and other verses that Jesus spoke about peace is that the peace that Christians have does not come from the outward absence of struggle and effort. On the contrary, we're supposed to be striving. That means wrestling. We're supposed to be struggling in some ways to do the right thing in a world that's going the wrong way. That peace comes in the middle of struggle. It's an inner peace. And that peace comes from knowing that we've made right decisions. We've decided to pursue correct goals in our lives, goals that in the end are going to work out very well for all of those who choose that path. In an effort to illustrate this a little bit, I'm going to tell you a few stories about a time of struggle that occurred in the world and how a lot of young people were involved in it and did some very heroic and courageous things. I'd like to ask you to cast your imagination back to the late 1930s and early 1940s. It was a time when Nazi Germany occupied almost all of Europe. And I'm especially going to be dealing with what happened in France because my wife and I lived there for 9 years. We talked with people who went through some of these experiences, and we witnessed some of the places where these events occurred, and that's the country I know best in Europe. So I'll use France as an example, although similar stories played out in most of Western Europe. There was a time in France during the years that I just mentioned when in the evenings people would close the curtains in their apartments, turn off most of the lights, and they would pull out a shortwave radio. And they would turn the volume down low because they couldn't take a chance that the neighbors would overhear what they were listening to. And they would tune in to one particular radio station and one particular radio program that they were eager to listen to. They kept the volume low because if they were caught, they could be imprisoned for the simple fact of listening to this forbidden frequency and this forbidden program. But they took the risk because they were hungry for news of what was going on in the world. All they could get on the legal radio stations was propaganda, lies, things that were dressed up to fool people. And they wanted to know what was really going on. And so they tuned in to what was called in French Radio Londres, Radio London. And it was a radio program produced every day by French people who had escaped to London. And it came out over the BBC frequency. It was entirely in French, produced by French people. The announcement at the beginning of the show said, French people are talking to French people. And people knew that there they were going to get some truth. So they heard news. They heard the news of what was really going on in the war around the world. They heard some music. They heard some comedy sketches. That was part of it as well. And sometimes they would hear strange coded messages without any context that people couldn't understand. They didn't know what it was. And I have some here that were actually read over the radio during this time. So these are some of the coded messages that people heard as they were listening to this radio station. John has a long mustache. Then they move on to the next message, which might be, there's a fire at the insurance agency. Napoleon's hat is in the ring. John loves Mary. The arrow will not pass. The Trojan War will not be held. These were coded messages destined for different groups of people who knew who they were, but nobody else knew who they were. And it was a message being transmitted to people who were working with the Allies based in London. And then one day, a particularly sought-after message was heard. It was the most important message that had gone out over Radio Londres for 5 long years. Here's what it was. Les sanglots longs des violons de l'automne blessent mon cœur d'une longueur monotone. It's a line of French poetry from Paul Verlaine. How many of you understood that? Okay, a few hands, that's good. Let me read you a translation. The long sobs of the violins of autumn wound my heart with a languorous monotony. Now, how many of you understood it? Okay, I think fewer than before. There was a secret meaning in that verse by Verlaine, and most people didn't understand what it meant. But for the few thousand who knew what it did mean, their hearts began to race, and they got excited as they hadn't in years. probably don't have any idea what that signified. Maybe some of you do. Usually there are a couple who know when I use that quotation. But while you're thinking about that, while you're trying to figure out what significance that might have had, let me tell you another story. And these are all true stories that I'll be telling you today, things that actually happened. This is a story that happened to a teenager living in the Netherlands, what we sometimes call Holland. Her name was Tiny Mulder, and she was a teenager in the city of Drachten. On a particular summer day in 1940, she was really nervous. She hardly saw the beautiful canals of Amsterdam as she walked through the city toward the train station, and as she walked occasionally, she would reach up and touch her green hat to make sure it was still there. That was her secret identification. She was a teenager, but she was doing something very important and very dangerous. She was carrying maps of the German army positions in the Netherlands. She was a courier, and her job was to take this information to the port of Rotterdam, where her contact, whom she didn't know and he didn't know her, would recognize her because she'd be the only person wearing a green hat, and they'd make contact. She was supposed to give him the plans, the maps, and he was going to get those to London. If she were caught, she would be arrested, probably tortured, sent to a prison or a prison camps, or maybe she might just have been shot or hung. That's what she was risking. How did such a young person end up in such a situation? You probably remember some of this from your history classes, although less and less is being taught in American schools, unfortunately. In 1930, you remember, Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany, and he and his Nazi party began immediately developing a very modern army, modern tanks, artillery, fighters, bombers, battleships, and a whole generation of soldiers who were raised from their childhood to follow orders without question and to show no pity. Then in September of 1939, Hitler unleashed that army on Poland. It was a blatant, outright invasion, and World War II began officially in earnest. Poland fell to Germany, followed by the rest of Europe, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, and finally France. By the end of 1940, the entire European continent, except Switzerland, which remained neutral, was under the boot of dictatorships. Only Great Britain continued the fight. Europe was, the term is used now, occupied. That is, the Germans sent in their own officers and organizers to be in charge of these countries that they had conquered. And all of those societies were organized to help the Germans continue in their war effort. The factories in these occupied countries had to make weapons for the German army. Much of the food that was grown in these countries had to be sent to the German armies that were fighting in other parts of the world. And anyone who complained about it or refused to cooperate was arrested. People were tortured, killed. Secret police kept files on people so they could find out who wasn't cooperating with the Nazi effort. There were informants, low-life criminal types, who were paid sums of money to pass information to the German secret police about who wasn't cooperating so those people could be arrested and punished. This was called the occupation. And occupied France was under the government of Germany. It was a very dark and frightening time in Europe. I've had the chance to talk to people who lived through that, and it was a very scary time. The Germans seemed so strong at that point, it seemed impossible that they would be dislodged. Hitler often said that his Reich or his government was going to last 1,000 years, and at the time it certainly seemed to be true. What did French people do under these circumstances? Well, many of them, most of them, just kept their heads down. They didn't help, they didn't hurt, they just tried to get along as best they could. Not cause any trouble, not anger the occupiers, not catch the attention of the informants, just keep their heads down and keep going. Other folks took advantage of what they saw as an opportunity. Hey, if they worked with the Germans, they could make some money, they could get rich. Sometimes they'd be rewarded with positions of responsibility and power. Some of them even ended up ruling entire countries under the German regime. At least they could make some money. These people were called collaborators, co-laborers. They worked with the Germans, and they had a pretty good time under the Nazi occupation. They helped find Jews, send them to concentration camps where millions died, and they informed on their countrymen who were arrested. They helped the Nazi cause, and they were richly rewarded for it. One of the first men that I met around the Geneva, Switzerland area when I was a student working on my French over in Switzerland and France was a man named Henrion, and he told me his story. He was a patriotic young Frenchman, a Parisian. He was standing in line at a cinema in the early 1940s. He was waiting to buy his ticket. He saw some German soldiers marching by, and he muttered under his breath to his friend standing next to him, "Sale Bosch, dirty Krauts." And that was all it took. There was an informant in the line with him. And shortly thereafter, secret police showed up at his apartment. He was arrested and taken away, and he spent the rest of the war in Auschwitz for something as simple as saying, "You dirty Krauts, what are you doing here?" It was collaborators who turned in Anne Frank's family, the young woman who wrote the famous diary. That's why she ended up dying. And they turned in many other Jewish families throughout all of Europe. But there were others, not very numerous. There were a few who felt strongly enough and determined enough and courageous enough to resist the occupying power. They came to be called the underground or the resistance. And many of them acted with incredible courage to stand up against something awful and do what they could to stop it. They risked their lives, doing things like gathering information about German troop locations, helping pilots who'd been shot down sneak back to England so that they could fight again, saving Jews from being sent to death camps, sabotaging factory production so that Germany would have fewer tanks and airplanes. They blew up bridges and sabotaged things and so on and so forth. If they were caught, and many were, they were killed. They would go to prison. They'd be tortured. Sometimes even their family members were arrested and sent to concentration camps. But they kept their eyes on England and the United States and to a lesser extent Russia, who were fighting to stop the Germans. And so they tuned in to Radio London and they tried to keep their spirits up and keep focused on what they had to do. That's what Tiny Mulder was doing on that summer day in 1940. Would you like to know what happened to her? Be patient. I'll get back to it. Stay with me. Some of you may be thinking this is a rather unusual introduction to a sermon. First of all, it's a long introduction, but some unusual stuff in it as well. French poetry, a girl named Tiny, name from the X-Files, green hat. What is all this history that comes from your parents' time, your grandparents' time, great-grandparents' time? What could that possibly have to do with you sitting here in Louisville today? Well, I'm here to try to show you that there's a big connection between these stories and the story of your life in the next few years. Because what happened in World War II in the early 1940s is really only a weak echo of something far worse that happened thousands of years earlier. There was at that time another war, a far more important and destructive war. And it began a terrible occupation, causing untold misery and suffering, and that occupation is still going on today. You know that before God created human beings, he created millions, perhaps billions, of angels, spirit beings that we cannot see, but that the Bible reveals to be extremely powerful. Some angels were even more powerful than others. They were created to sort of manage the work of other angels. And apparently, at the top end of the structure, the spiritual structure that God made, there were three archangels, almost certainly what the Bible calls cherubim. And three of them, there are only three angels in the Bible that are mentioned by name. Michael and Gabriel, you recognize those names. And there's another mentioned by his name in the Bible as well. In Hebrew, his name is Hillel, which means the light bringer or the light bearer. But we usually use the Latin translation of his name, which is Lucifer. And from what the Bible tells us, Lucifer actually worked in the presence of God himself. There's a passage in Isaiah and Ezekiel that indicates that his wings were stretched out over the throne of God himself, much like what was represented on the cover of the Ark of the Covenant. Angels with their wings spread out over the mercy seat, representing the throne of God. He worked in the presence of God. his wings stretched out over, apparently, God the Father himself. But those scriptures I mentioned, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, show that at some point, Lucifer changed his mind. He didn't want to serve God anymore. He wanted to serve himself. He wanted to overthrow God and rule in his place. He wanted to take over all of God's creation. And he managed to convince other angels, apparently a third of them, to come over to what we might call the dark side and to fight against their own creator. I find something interesting written about that in Revelation 12. Let's look at Revelation 12, verse 7. I would like to know exactly what this looked like here. This must have been a very amazing thing. Revelation chapter 12, verse 7. Revelation 12, verse 7. War broke out in heaven. Imagine that, a war in heaven. What would that would have been like? Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. Michael is a warrior archangel who leads the angels that are faithful to God into battle when that's necessary. Other passages indicate he fights for Israel behind the scenes in the spirit realm. So Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. When this rebellion was attempted against God, God's angels overcame these rebellious angels, and they weren't allowed to be in heaven anymore. So the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast with him. Like I said, I would like to be able to really imagine truly what that must have been like. The scene that comes to my mind when I try to imagine this, you may have other ones that come to your mind, but I think of that scene in the second Lord of the Rings movie where Gandalf is fighting with the Balrog, and they're going at it with these spiritual weapons. Is there really a spiritual Glamdring somewhere? I don't know. What did they fight with? We don't know. But there was a fight like that, and Satan was cast back down to the earth. And you know what? That's still where he is. He's down here. And we just read here in Revelation that he deceives the whole world. Now think about what that means. When you're deceived, by definition, you don't know you're deceived. Right? If you knew you were deceived, then you wouldn't be deceived. That's the way the definition of the word works. So he deceives the whole world. He makes them think things that are not right, and they don't know that that's happening. That's the deception that's going on here on earth. He deceives the whole world. He wanted to knock God off his throne. He was projected back down here on the earth, and he's still here, and he's still deceiving the whole world. Why am I mentioning this? Because one of the questions we asked at the beginning was, we live in a troubled world. Why is that? Because Satan is down here deceiving people. That's why the world is a troubled place. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, if you would. 2 Corinthians 4. Starting in verse 3. 2 Corinthians 4, starting in verse 3. Paul wrote to the Corinthian Christians here, and he said, even if our gospel is veiled, so there's something in front of eyes that prevents seeing clearly, even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. They're on a way that's going to lead them to death, ultimately. Whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. The God of this age, who is that? Well, it's Satan. He's blinded the minds of people that are here on the earth. That's how the devil of old deceives the whole world. He throws a spiritual veil in front of their eyes, and he prevents them from seeing things. He hides the truth from them so they can't see it. And because they're deceived, they don't even know that that's going on. They're unaware of the whole process that's occurring there. Some of you, in fact, probably all of us now, because it's so much entered into popular culture over the last 10 or 15 years, you know about the movie called The Matrix. I am not putting my seal of approval on it. It's quite violent. But the underlying idea is really intriguing, and like I said, it's entered our modern culture now. Everybody knows about VR and The Matrix, and there are common references to it all the time. The underlying idea of The Matrix is really quite intriguing on a spiritual level. It's also about a group of resistance fighters, science fiction ones, these, in a time in the future where after a nuclear war, the Earth has been destroyed, and the sunlight can't pierce through the clouds. There's no sources of energy left in the world, but there's this huge computer network left over from the previous age, and it wants to keep itself functioning. What to use for power? It decides to use human beings, the electrical field that we generate around our bodies. So you know how it goes. People end up in these little tanks filled with goop, and they are all wired up so that the machine can harvest their energy. But to keep them cooperative and compliant, the Matrix jacks their brains into a virtual reality. So that while these people are in these uncomfortable, cramped, goop-filled tanks with wires protruding from their bodies, they think they're in a pretty cool place that resembles New York City in the 20th century. Okay, it's science fiction. You probably know the story. There are a few people that get unplugged from the Matrix, and they live in the real world. And the real world is cold and gritty, and it's kind of hard. And through the course of the movies, they heroically fight against the Matrix and its killer computer programs. That's the general story. But based on the scriptures we've seen in the Bible, isn't that on a spiritual level pretty close to what Satan has done to humanity? He hides the reality of things behind an illusion. People think they know what's going on. They think they've got a good grasp of what's happening in the world. But it's an illusion. It's not true. They're not really living in reality. Hardly anyone sees through the illusion to know the true God. So there are false gods out there that have seduced many people. The false gods of Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. False god of evolution, which believes there is no God at all. Even false versions of Christianity hide the truth from people, the truth of the God of the Bible. And sometimes Satan just gets people so involved in diversions, time wasters, Xbox, sports, internet. Now, not all of that is bad, but some people take it way too far. A lot of people do today. And it takes up so much of their thinking and so much of their mental activity, they have no time to even think about God or think about having a relationship with Him. Satan disguises himself. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, if you would. Second Corinthians 11, we'll start reading in verse 13. Such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Satan transforms himself into an angel of light. He pretends to be something that he is not. And he has ministers who help him. Now, he's fooled, most of them as well. They don't really know what they're doing. They may not know what they're actually involved in, but they're helping him. And Satan has disguised reality. He makes the right way of life look hard and bad. He makes wrong ways of life look really good. And respected people in this world are helping him do his dirty work because they themselves are deceived. People reject God's law. They think it's a burden. Even most Christians think that God's law is a burden, when in reality, respecting it would set humanity free from most of the suffering that's going on right now. But they don't see that. They can't. And so we have wars, and we have messed up families, and we have messed up sexuality, and we have messed up lives, because people believe Satan's matrix. People reject God. Satan is even convinced, and this is perhaps one of his greatest triumphs, He's convinced people he doesn't even exist. Most people don't believe that there's really a devil, that there's really a Satan. But the Bible says there is. I'm going to read Job 1, verses 6 and 7. You can turn there if you want, but I'll read it to you. Job 1, verses 6 and 7. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Why does God allow Satan to come by once in a while? I have no idea. It just says he does. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it." Wow. Where is Satan? He's down here walking around. He's just walking around seeing what kind of trouble he can stir up. I think he spends a lot of time in the Middle East. I think he spends a lot of time in North Korea. I know he spends a lot of time in Hollywood. You can be sure of that. He's walking around. He's keeping people fooled. He's stirring the pot of suffering and misery to keep that cycle going from generation to generation. Because Satan hates people. He hates you. Why? You haven't done anything to him, have you? No, but you have a potential that Satan will never be able to have, that angels cannot have. You were made in the image of God. And God created you so that one day you can be a member of his family and live on the same level of existence as him. That is something that God never intended for the angels. And perhaps, just perhaps, that's one thing that caused Satan to rebel, jealousy. If he couldn't have it, then people couldn't have it either. And he was going to turn things over. In John chapter 8, verse 42, Jesus said the devil was a murderer from the beginning, and there is no truth in him. Satan is a murderer from the beginning, and there's no truth in him. He just lies. He'll sell you lies if you let him do it. Is there suffering and misery and murder in the world? It happens millions of times a day. Satan has, we could say, occupied the world. He's down here walking around, making people suffer. He's bending this world to his own use to keep people away from God, make them miserable, and ultimately to get them so twisted spiritually that God won't be able to straighten them out and sort them out and let them be a part of his family. That's what Satan wants to do, to destroy us utterly. Now, most people today, whether they know it or not, they're pretty much living like most French people did under the German occupation. They're just trying to get along. Just get by. Don't buck the system. Don't cause problems. Try to escape the worst of what's bad out there. Just get by. Some people are collaborating. Now, they may not actually know that that's what they're doing, but they are. There are people getting rich off Satan's wrong ways of life. There are dictators in the world who today are crushing peoples and nations just to get more power or more money for themselves. They have billions of dollars stashed away in accounts, and people are starving in their countries. We have hip-hop singing stars that glorify violence and drugs and elicit degrading sexual relationships. They make a lot of money doing that, make it seem really cool. We have movie stars make lots and lots of money taking their clothes off to make people lust, to suggest in their movies that sex outside of marriage is really cool, and that's what we should aspire to. Now, homosexuality and other aberrations are being presented as normal just about everywhere you look. And, in fact, those are things that God despises because they make people suffer, because in the end, that's a way that leads to death. And the Bible, which is God's word to us, is increasingly portrayed in modern culture as an evil thing. It's full of hatred. It's that book of hate. That's what people are saying now. And that, of course, is blasphemy. But in the middle of this tableau, which doesn't look so good so far, there are people who are resisting. There are people who are resisting Satan. They're not going along with him. They're living in occupied territory, but they're looking forward to a liberation that the Bible promises will come. God has unplugged a few people from Satan's matrix, and he tells them, join the resistance. Does that sound like I'm exaggerating? Am I trying too hard? God says, join the resistance, really? Okay, you don't believe me? Turn to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. Verse 7. James chapter 4, verse 7. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. See, the devil's in charge, more or less, in the world. He's deceived the whole world. But God has unplugged a few people from the matrix. They know what's going on. They can see behind the scenes. They can see that Satan's really the god of this age. And God tells them, resist him. Not only that, he says, if you resist him and if you submit to me, I will make him run away from you. Just as Jesus overcame the power of Satan, God will make it possible for us to do that if we so choose. We have a choice. We all have a choice. Free moral agency. Each of us gets to choose. You remember that scene in The Matrix when Morpheus is there with Neo and he holds out two pills? You can take the blue pill, you can take the red pill. Take the blue pill, you're going to wake up in your bedroom, think whatever you think, everything will be the same, you'll just continue in the matrix. You take the red pill, and everything's going to change, and you're going to see things the way they really are. So he had a choice there. He was kind of half in and half out, and he had to make a choice, which way am I going to go? In many ways, that's the case for those of us who grow up as young people in the church, which I did. And we have a choice to make. Blue pill, red pill. Stay in the matrix, just go along with what Satan is doing, or do I want out of that and to be a part of something that's really going to make a difference? 1 Peter chapter 5, please. 1 Peter chapter 5. Start reading in verse 6. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. But be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him. Don't go along with him. Resist him. Steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. We're all going through the same situation. The details change from country to country. And frankly, in most of the West, we have it the best of any place in the world as far as being Christians. But fundamentally, the spiritual struggle that's going on, we're all involved in the same struggle. Verse 10 says, may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a little while, it's not always easy, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. That means having peace. When we're settled, we're at peace. So in James 4, it says, resist the devil. In 1 Peter 5, it says, resist him. Hebrews 12, verses 3 and 4 say, you have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. There is resistance involved in that. And that's a reference to Jesus in Luke 22, 44. It says he prayed so intently that his sweat looked like it was blood. That's how much he struggled to resist sin. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6, if you would also, please. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, so we're not getting involved in the physical fights of the world. That's not what we're supposed to do. But against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Yeah, we're involved in a struggle. There's a spiritual war going on down here on earth. Satan's the god of this age. And he's got most of the world pretty well sewn up. But there's that small group that is faithful to God and is resisting him, Satan. The resistance. Turn back just a couple of pages to Ephesians 2, and we'll read verses 2 and 3. Ephesians 2, verses 2 and 3. Verse 1 says, "You were made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world." This is the way everybody's going. This is the flow. This is the river flow is going this way. "According to the prince of the power of the air." Oh, we have another title for Satan now. He's the god of this world. He's also the prince of the power of the air. What does that mean? What does he do as the prince of the power of the air? He's the spirit who works in the sons of disobedience. So he's emanating attitudes, and he's pushing people toward disobedience. He loves disobedience because he's the first disobeyer. Does that word exist? He was the first one to disobey. He disobeyed God, and he wants other people. He wants everybody to do that. He wants other angels to do that. He wants you to do that. And he'd like to start by getting you to disobey your parents, if he can. And then maybe throw in some disobedience at school, and you can see where all of that leads. And ultimately, you get rebellions and civil wars and other kinds of wars. It all starts with an attitude of disobedience. He works in the children of disobedience today, the sons of disobedience. "Among whom also," verse 3, "we also once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others." Pretty much everybody starts out more or less in the same boat. But then God comes along and he says, "I'm going to unplug this one, and I'm going to give him a choice. He can choose. You still have to choose. We all still have to choose. But he's giving you the privilege of being able to make the choice." And he doesn't do that with just anybody yet. The day will come when everyone will have a choice, but right now that's not the case. Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. There's something interesting that you need to understand about yourselves, the young people who are here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 14. "The unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy." If you have one parent who is a member of the Church of God, who submitted his or her life to God, then you pass into a different category. God considers you to be holy. That means at some point in your life, you're going to have the opportunity to make that choice. You can call it the blue pill or the red pill. You can call it, are you going to follow the way of the world or are you going to be obedient to God? You're going to have to make that choice. And that's quite an honor, because very few people today even are given that opportunity. But he's given it to you. He's given it to you. "One or both of your parents have accepted God's invitation, and that's why it's open to you now as well. Your parents are part of the resistance. In fact, they go to covert training sessions every Saturday. One of the characters in the movie The Matrix is named Cypher. He gets unplugged with the others. He starts out doing pretty well, starts out in the resistance, but he gets worn down over time. It's really hard. And he decides, you know, I'd rather be plugged back into the Matrix again rather than have to do all of this. You probably remember that scene. He's sitting there with the agent, and they're eating this cyber steak that doesn't really exist. And he puts a piece of it in his mouth, and he says, you know, I know this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it's juicy and delicious. But after 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss. So he betrays his comrade so he can get plugged back into the illusion once again. And of course, it doesn't work, and he gets killed. But in some ways, young people in the Church of God have to make a decision about that. Are they going to go with the comfortable flow and just not think about the Bible and the church? Some young people make that decision. No, don't tell me about it. I don't want to hear about it. I'm going to concentrate over here. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to do what I want to do. Just don't keep reminding me about this, because I don't want to make that choice. There was a time I grew up in the church. I had to face that myself. What was I going to do? It was my choice, ultimately. Which choice was I going to make? It sometimes seemed a lot easier just to go with the flow. Because if you swim against the stream, you'll pay a price for it, at sometimes at least. Probably many of you have grown up in the church, you've had to do that. You feel a little bit different. You stand out. And it can be uncomfortable at times. You probably had to deal with that already. It's not easy to resist. And Satan will try to get you to give up and take the easy way. And sadly, he succeeds sometimes with some young people in the church. One of his favorite tactics is to throw stuff at you. He can throw lots of stuff your way to distract you from the decision you need to make. He can also put attitudes in your minds that are really seductive. He's called the prince of the power of the air who works in the children of disobedience. So he specializes in attitudes of disobedience. That things that start with pride or anger or confusion or discouragement or hopelessness. He's got all kinds of tactics. He knows those really well. But the underlying attitude behind it all, the recurring thought will be, don't obey God. Thou shalt not surely die. Taste the fruit. Look how good it looks. Don't listen to your parents. They're so ancient. They were born so long ago. They can't possibly understand what you're thinking and what you're going through today. I thought that when I was a teenager. My parents thought that when they were teenagers. And I bet there are a few people here that have had that thought grow through their minds also. You know where that thought comes from? Not from God. Don't submit. Think for yourself. Do what you want. Do what seems fun. Go your own way. Those are so many ways for Satan to say, hey, work with me. I'll make it worth your while. It'll be fun. Collaborate with me. He will do whatever he can to keep people away from God and his way of life. Look what he tried with Jesus in Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, verse 8. This is where Satan is trying to cause Jesus to sin, which is pretty presumptuous, because when we understand that Jesus was the Word who became flesh and that everything that was made by him, it was the Word who became Jesus who actually gave life to Lucifer in the beginning. When Lucifer opened his spiritual eyes for the first time, the first thing he saw was the person who became Jesus Christ, the Word. And now he's trying to outsmart his own creator here and get him to worship him. And he's trying his best shots. He's really giving it his best shots here. And this is the best one. Chapter 4, verse 8. The devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain, and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. That's really what he wants. What was Jesus' response? Jesus said, hey, you're lying. You don't have all that to give. No, he didn't say that. He responded from the Bible, which is the best response, but there's kind of a tacit acknowledgement that Satan could have given all that stuff. He's got that to give. He's got that to throw around. Now, he wouldn't have done it because he's a liar, but he could promise you a lot of things, and he'll deliver maybe a little bit at the beginning to convince you to keep going. Satan had those things to give. He will trade you lots of stuff to keep your mind going a different way from the way God wants you to go. He'll give you physical things. He can toss money your way. And a high-paying job has taken some young people out of the Church of God. You want iPads? You want to watch MTV? You want a car? You want a boyfriend, a girlfriend? You want PlayStation? You want cool stuff to make you feel good? He'll supply it for a while. The one thing he won't let you know is that it's not going to last. That life goes by incredibly quickly. And then if you go down that way, you're wasting your time. And at the end of it, you won't have anything spiritual to show for the time you spent here on earth. It'll just be empty, and there'll be nothing but regrets. But people have been falling for that bait and switch for 6,000 years. And there are millions of people doing it today, right now, as we speak. God has unplugged you from Satan's matrix. You can see the reality of things if you choose to do so. What are you going to do? Ultimately, only you can decide for yourself. Nobody else can make that decision for you. You're going to have to decide for yourself at some point in your life. Will you collaborate or will you join the resistance? Ultimately, the Bible tells us there are only two paths that you can take. You can either follow God, and if you don't do that, you're following Satan. Turn to Romans chapter 6, please. Romans 6. Romans 6, verse 16. When I was a teen, I knew, I was very convinced that God was good, God's way was good. I'd learned that from my childhood. But God's way was kind of hard. You know, keeping the commandments, not going out with my friends when they're all going out on Friday night. So that was kind of hard. So I was looking for another option. I didn't want to go with Satan's way. Because he's bad. I mean, I don't want to have anything to do with him. So bad, hard, I decided I was going to go take the third route in the middle. So you have God's way, Satan's way, Joel Meeker's way. That's what I was going to take that road. So I wasn't going to follow Satan. That'd be bad, but you know, God's way is pretty hard sometimes. Then I discovered this verse. Verse 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey? Here are the choices. Whether of sin to death or of obedience to righteousness. That wiped out my third option. There are only two. Either you follow God, part of the resistance, or if you're not doing that, you're following Satan. You're collaborating. There are really only two choices. There is no third option. Now, there are a couple of kinds of resistance in which we can engage. There is what I call passive resistance. That means just not going along with what Satan is doing. Turn to James chapter 1, verse 27. James 1, 27. James chapter 1, verse 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Keep yourself unspotted from the world. Don't get swept along with the wrong things that go on. Be careful what you watch. Be careful what you listen to, what you think about. Be careful how you act. There's a lot of filth and stink out there in the world, and if you're not careful, some of it will get on you, maybe even in you. Passive resistance just says, I'm not going to let that happen. I'm going to keep myself unspotted. I'm not going to go along with what's wrong in the world. A number of years, my wife and I lived in Alsace in eastern France on the border with Germany, and a lot of Alsatians speak a dialect of German. So when the German occupation occurred, the German army wanted all those young Alsatian men and tried to enroll them in the German army because they understood enough German to follow orders, and they would keep their families sort of hostage to make sure that they obeyed. Throughout Alsace, there was a lot of passive resistance. No, we're just not going to cooperate. Some people weren't going to fight them openly, but they certainly were not going to cooperate. And there's some interesting stories that came out of that period of time. For example, there was a German language newspaper in a city called Mulhouse, where I used to be a pastor for a while. And there was an article that was printed in the newspaper that talked about Adolf Hitler's famous book, Mein Kampf, which means my struggle. Except when the newspaper came out, by accident it was misprinted and it said Mein Kampf, which means my idiocy. The paper sold out immediately. Everybody wanted one. A whole town was talking about it and laughing. The German secret police showed up at the newspaper. The editor said it was the proofreader's fault. The proofreader said it was a typo. The Germans sent them to hard labor for 4 months. When young men were called into the army or to work details, they'd have to have a physical first, and sometimes a doctor would help them get out of it. One doctor developed a special shot that made people break out in bright red spots. It looked so awful that the German doctors wouldn't let them in the army. There was an epidemic of that disease. Another doctor would put healthy arms in cast and write reports stating that they were broken to keep young men at home. Some would operate and take out a perfectly good appendix. Of course, it took months to recover from an operation like that, so no time in the German army. In Colmar, a city right near where we used to live, the statistics for illness between 1941 and 1944 quadrupled. There were 400% more sick people in Colmar during that time to keep young men from going into the German army. That's an acceptable part of resistance. Don't get carried along. Don't get pulled into wrong things. You know, I don't need to tell you what those things are. You know what they are. Don't do things that will damage your health. Don't get into wrong attitudes. Don't give in to anger and hatred and superiority or hopelessness. And you have a lot of control over that. Don't cheat on your future husband or wife, the person you will love most in the world, with whom you want to spend your life. Don't cheat on them. Don't break laws, as Mr. Winter said in the announcements, man's laws or God's laws. If you do, you're collaborating with Satan. Then there's active resistance. Look at 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter 3, verse 10. 2 Peter 3, verse 10. We'll read through verse 12. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise. The elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in them will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, the elements will melt with fervent heat. Did you catch that at the beginning of verse 12? Looking for and hastening the day of the Lord. Is that possible? Is there something that you and I could do that would make that day come more quickly? That's what it says. Hasten the day. Make it come more quickly. There are apparently things we can do. If we all work together and we all do our part, we might cause God to bring it a little more quickly, because maybe things will be prepared for it a little more quickly. That's active resistance. That's doing things actively to make sure, to do our part, to hasten the day. There were a lot of heroic resistance movements in Europe. Not all Germans were bad. They weren't all Nazis. In fact, one of the most heroic of all the resistance movements in Europe was actually inside of Germany. During the war, there were Germans who fought the Nazi Party. One of the most famous in Germany today is a group called the White Rose. It was composed of university students operating in the heart of Nazi territory, Munich. Hans and Sophie Scholl were a brother and sister team that distributed tracts against the Nazis in their university, the heart of Nazism, along with professors and others. To them, it didn't matter if their whole nation was going mad and was going almost in lockstep the wrong direction. They weren't going to go, and they were going to try to convince others not to go. What you're doing is wrong. Think about what you're doing. They would stand for justice and truth. They were caught, and they were guillotined. But they're still great heroes in Germany today on postage stamps. Schools are named after them. The Germans of today are proud of Hans and Sophie Scholl. 77,000 German resistance members were executed by the Nazis during the war. That's a lot of people. Maybe not a lot percentage-wise when you take the whole country, but that's a lot of people who are willing to stand up and do the right thing. And that's what Tiny Mulder was doing in the Netherlands. She delivered the maps that day and many other days. And as the occupation went on and the resistance movement continued, she was given more and more responsible jobs to do. She saved pilots that were shot down over the Netherlands and got them to Spain so they could be smuggled back to England to fight once again. She saved the lives of Jewish children, even adopting one into her own family. She acted with very cool courage. One time, she was just a few steps ahead of the German soldiers when she reached a pilot who had been downed. So she quickly had him change into civilian garments. Then she took his arm, put her head on his shoulder, and walked right by the German soldiers. The Germans are thinking, nobody gets a girlfriend that fast. He's got to be from around here. By the end of the war, she was running her own resistance cell. in her early 20s. She had a lot of people reporting to her. Active resistance. What are some things you should be doing, we should all be doing actively to resist Satan? Learn the Bible. Live it. Bible study is not just for adults. It's for people of all ages. Timothy knew the Bible from his youth, and Paul said that was a great advantage to him. Study the Bible. Make the decision to let God guide your life. That's a conscious decision you'll have to make. Work to prepare the way for the return of Jesus Christ. Pray, thy kingdom come every day. That's something we're all supposed to do. Start doing that. Get involved in your congregation. Go see your pastor. Tell him you're willing to help out. Ask him if there's something you can do. Maybe you've got some knowledge or expertise that would be useful. Help with the sound system. Hand out hymnals. Lots of things that can be done. Get involved. Be a part of the life of your congregation. Help people. The Frank family, Anne Frank, who wrote that famous diary, they only survived as long as they did because they had a team of people who helped them and supported them. The Franks just called them the helpers, and they depended on them for their lives. Now, I told you they were eventually turned in by collaborators, but if it hadn't been for the helpers, they wouldn't have made it that far. Be a helper. Help people. We should be helping each other. The results of the choices we make will be either a reward, a wonderful reward, or the Bible tells us, shame. You take one pill, you're going to have glory and honor and eternal life. You take the other one, it's going to be shame. The time will come. At the start of the war, when Britain and France had behaved badly and had given up Czechoslovakia without a fight, Winston Churchill, who wasn't going to do that, said, Britain and France had a choice between dishonor and war. They chose dishonor, and they will have war. He knew that there could be no compromise with Adolf Hitler. There's no compromise with Satan the devil either. You can't compromise with him. He will have only complete victory or nothing. So the choice really isn't about avoiding the fight or not. It's about, are we going to fight honorably, or will we choose dishonor? On June 6, 1944, the Allies landed in Normandy. I've had the chance to walk those beaches many times. It's a very thought-provoking place. And little by little, they began pushing the Germans back out of France. And the collaborators began feeling anxious and nauseous because they thought they had compromised with the winning side. They thought the Reich was going to last 1,000 years. And now it was being beaten. And they found out the Germans didn't really care about them anyway. They were just being used. When the Allies finally overtook certain territories, the people who had suffered under the collaborators, they took their revenge. Women were stripped to their underwear, their heads were shaved, and they were made to take a walk of shame through the middle of town while people yelled insults at them and threw things at them. And the men usually were just summarily executed, shot, or hung. But at the same time, there were others who had worked in the shadows in very difficult circumstances. Many times people didn't know who they were. But suddenly they were revealed as heroes. And the full extent of what they'd been willing to do finally came to light. They had proven that they were people of character and courage. And all of the post-war governments in Europe, all of the presidents and elected officials, all of the governors, they were all former resistors because the people knew we can trust these people to do the right thing. And that's what's going to happen to your parents. And that's what's going to happen to you if you want that. If you want that. There's going to be a revelation in the time, at that time. Hebrews 11, verse 33 to 40 says, the world is not worthy of the saints today, even though nobody knows who they are. Romans 8, verse 19 talks about the revealing of the sons of God. Suddenly we're going to see who they are. The world's going to see who they are. They don't know now, but they will then. And some will be ashamed at the same time. And that's something, obviously, we don't want to do. 1 John chapter 2, verse 28 says, now, little children, abide in him, that when he appears, we may have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming. That's 1 John 2:28. Some people will be ashamed. But some will be glorified. Some will be glorified. Which would we rather have? Obviously, we'd rather have glory, not shame. We've all faced shame, shameful circumstances before. I've done stupid things. I can remember my parents telling me, "What were you thinking? How could you do this?" And I usually didn't have a very good answer. It seemed like a good idea at the time. That doesn't work very well. We don't want to be, none of us like to be ashamed. But the Bible says that's going to happen to some. But others will be glorified. We read that in Romans 8, verse 16. We are children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs to God, and joint heirs with Christ. If indeed we suffer with him, that we may be glorified with him. And I want to read Revelation chapter 3, verse 5, and I want you, please, to try to imagine the circumstance in your mind. Revelation 3, verse 5. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life. Look at this last part now. But I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. I will confess his name. Now, the way I imagine that, you can imagine it however you want, but I imagine Christians kind of in a line. Space isn't going to mean the same thing to us at that time, so we probably won't really have to line up. We'll be outside of space by that time. But somehow our turn is going to come, and the glorified Jesus Christ is going to have us stand next to him, and he's going to say, "Father, I want to introduce this one to you. You know him already, but I want to state his name, her name, in your presence, and in the presence of all these holy angels, because he's done well. She's done well." Wow. Can you imagine an experience like that? I can barely imagine that. What an amazing thing that would be, but that's what it says. I will confess his name before my Father and the holy angels. So, where will you be at that time, when that big day comes? God's resistance movement is not only for adults. He pays attention to what young people do as well. There are stories in the Bible, lots of stories about young people who had an important part to play in what God was doing. Like Tiny Mulder and Hans and Sophie Scholl. You can make a big difference too. We need you to make a big difference. What about that verse by Verlaine at the beginning of the sermon? It was read over Radio London. Most people who heard it didn't have a clue what it meant. It was nonsense to them, a message they couldn't understand. But to the resistance, who was in the know, it meant that the invasion of Normandy would start within 24 hours. And when they heard that message, their hearts soared. How many of you knew the significance of that phrase? Okay, see, there are a few hands out there. Some people knew what that meant. Most of you didn't. It was a mysterious thing. You couldn't know what was going on. But others knew. See, you have the possibility, the privilege of knowing in advance what's going to happen. You can be in the know and you can be a part of it. The hearts of the resistance fighters soared when they heard it, and they went to work preparing the terrain for that invasion. And a couple of weeks or a few months later, they were recognized as heroes in their nations. So, once again, you're unplugged from Satan's matrix. He wants to plug you back in. He can't make you do that. He can't forcibly plug you back in. You would have to let him do it. You'd have to cooperate with him for that to happen. You'd have to take the blue pill consciously and say, "No, I'm just going with the flow." Or you can say, "God's given me a choice. I'm going to take it. I'm going to make the good choice." Will you collaborate or will you resist like your parents before you? They hope, we all hope, that you'll choose to join the ranks and you'll stand shoulder to shoulder with everyone who's already made that decision, the rest of God's resistance around the world. More importantly than what your parents want, though, this is what your Creator, God Almighty, wants for you. He's planned that for you from the beginning. It's a life of effort, not always easy. There's struggle involved, but there's also fulfillment and joy in this life and even better things to come in the next. So much so, the Bible says you can't even compare with what's coming. That is the way for us to have peace and hope, true inner peace, because we will know that we've made the right choice, and that in the end, We're going to receive from God Almighty Himself honor and glory and immortality. So think it over carefully and join the resistance.